The walls of the Café de l'Univers were hung with paintings, etched mirrors, and enamel plaques advertising the ubiquitous product of Pernofi. The pictures, if one could call them that, were either grotesque daubs seemingly executed in a messy imitation of engine stippling, or queer geometric formulations suggesting the restless motion of kinetrope bits. In some cases, Oliphant supposed, the painters themselves were present, or such he took them to be, these long-haired fellows in velvet caps, their corduroy trousers smeared with pigment and tobacco ash. But the majority of the clientele, according to his companion, one Jean Béraud, consisted of kinotropistes. These gentlemen of the Latin Quarter sat and drank with their black-clad grisettes at the round marble table, or held forth on theoretical matters before small groups of their peers. Béraud, in an unseasonable boater and a brown suit of intensely Gallic cut, was one of Arslan's mouchards, a professional informer who referred to the kinotropistes as members of Le Milieu. He was fresh and rosy as a young pig. He drank vitel and peppermint, and Oliphant had taken an immediate dislike to him. The kinotropists seemed to favour the absinthe of Pernofi. Oliphant, sipping a glass of red wine, watched the ritual of glass and water decanter, of sugar lump and trowel-shaped spoon.
"Absinthe is the bed of tuberculosis," Béraud said.
"Why do you suppose that Madame Tournachon would choose to appear tonight in this café, Béraud?" The mouchard shrugged.
"She is a familiar of Le Milieu, monsieur. She goes to Madelon's, also to Batifolles, but it is here in l'Univers that she most nearly finds companionship."
"And why is that, do you think?"
"Because she was Gautier's mistress, of course. He was a kind of prince here, monsieur, it must be understood. Her relationship with Gautier has necessarily limited her contacts with ordinary society. He taught her French, or such French as she has."
"What sort of woman, exactly, do you take her to be?" Béraud smiled.
"She is perhaps attractive, but cold, unsympathetic, in the manner of English women, you understand."
"When she arrives, Béraud, if she arrives, I should say, you are to take your leave immediately." Béraud raised his eyebrows.
"On the contrary, monsieur."
"You are to go, Béraud. Take your leave." A measured pause. "Vanish."
The sharply padded shoulders of Béraud's brown suit rose at the word.
"You will instruct the cab to wait, and the stenographer as well. The stenographer, Béraud. His English is adequate, my friend. My very good friend, Monsieur Arslan, has assured me that this is the case."
"Entirely adequate, yes. And, monsieur," getting up so quickly that he nearly overturned his bentwood chair, "it is she."
The woman now entering l'Univers might easily have been mistaken for a modish Parisienne of more than common means. Slender and blonde, she wore a sombre merino crinoline with matching cloak and bonnet, narrowly trimmed in mink. As Béraud continued his hasty retreat into the depths of the café, Oliphant rose. Her eyes, very alert, very blue, met his. He approached her, hat in hand, and bowed. "Forgive me," he said in English. "We have not been introduced, but I must speak with you regarding a matter of great urgency." Recognition dawned in the wide blue eyes, and fear.
"Sir, you mistake me for another."
"You are Sybil Gerard." Her lower lip was trembling now, and Oliphant experienced an abrupt, powerful, and entirely unexpected sympathy.
"I am Laurence Oliphant, Miss Gerard. You are presently in terrible danger. I wish to help you." "That is not my name, sir. Pray let me pass. My friends are waiting."
"I know that Egremont betrayed you. I understand the nature of his betrayal." She started at the name, Oliphant in terror of her swooning on the spot, but then she gave a little shudder and seemed to study him quietly for a moment.
"I saw you in Grand's that night," she said. "You were in the smoker with Houston and Mick. You had a gammy arm up in a sling."
"Please," he said, "join me." Seated opposite her at his table, Oliphant listened as she ordered absinthe de vidangeur in quite passable French.
"Do you know Lamartine, the singer?" she asked.
"I'm sorry, no."
"He invented it. Scavenger's absinthe. I can't drink it otherwise."
The waiter arrived with the drink, a mixture of absinthe and red wine.
"Theo taught me to order it," she said, "before he went away."
She drank, the wine red against her painted lips.
"I know you've come to take me back. Don't gull me otherwise. I know a copper when I meet one."
"I have no desire to see you return to England, Miss Gerard."
"Tournachon. I'm Sybil Tournachon, French by marriage."
"Your husband is here in Paris?"
"No,"
she said, lifting an oval locket of cut steel on its black ribbon. She snapped it open, displaying a daguerreotyped miniature of a handsome young man.
"Aristide. He fell at Philadelphia in the Great Inferno. He volunteered to fight on the Union side. He was real, you know. I mean, he actually existed and wasn't just one of them the clackers make up."
She gazed at the little image with a look of mingled longing and sadness, though Oliphant understood that she had never in her life set eyes upon Aristide Tournachon. "It was a marriage of convenience, I take it?"
"Yes. And you've come to take me back?"
"Not at all, Miss Tournachon."
"I don't believe you."
"You must. A great deal depends upon it, not least your own safety. Since you departed London, Charles Egremont has become a very powerful, a very dangerous man, as dangerous to the well-being of Great Britain as he is no doubt dangerous to you."
"Charles? Dangerous?"
She seemed suddenly on the verge of laughter.
"You're gulling me."
"I need your help. Desperately. As desperately as you need mine."
"Do I, then?"
"Egremont has powerful resources at his command, branches of government easily capable of reaching you here."
"You mean the specials and that lot?"
"More to the point, I must inform you that your activities are even now monitored by at least one secret agency of Imperial France."
"Because Théophile chose to help me?"
"Indeed, that seems to be the case." She drank off the last of the vile-looking concoction in her glass.
"Dear Théophile, what a lovely, silly sort of cove he was. Always in his scarlet waistcoat, and madly clever at clacking. I gave him Mick's set of fancy cards, and he was terribly kind to me then. Spun me up a marriage license and a French citizen number, rat-tat-tat. Then, one afternoon, I was to meet him here."
"Yes?"
"He never came."
She lowered her eyes.
"He used to boast of having a gambling modus. They all do. But he talked as if he meant it. Someone might have believed him. It was foolish of him."
"Did he ever speak with you about his interest in the engine known as the Great Napoleon?"
"Their monster, you mean? Your Paris clacker speaks of little Elsa. They're mad for the thing."
"The French authorities believe that Théophile Gautier damaged the Great Napoleon with Radley's cards."
"Is he dead, then, Theo?"
Oliphant hesitated. "Alas, I believe so, yes."
"That's so vicious, bloody cruel," she said. "To spirit a man away like a rabbit in a conjuring trick, and leave his loved ones ever to wonder and worry and never rest. It's vile."
Oliphant found that he could not meet her eyes.
"There's a deal of that about in this Paris, there is," she said. "The things I've heard their clackers jest about. And London, they say, is no better, really, to them as no. Do you know, they say the Rads murdered Wellington. They say the sappers, the sand hogs, hand in glove with the Rads, cut a tunnel beneath that restaurant, and the master sapper himself tamped the powder and set the fuses. Then the Rads lay the blame on men like—"
"Your father."
"Yes, I know." "And knowing that, you'd ask me to trust you?"
There was defiance in her eyes, and perhaps a pride long buried. "Knowing that Charles Egremont betrayed your father, Walter Gerard, unto his destruction, that he betrayed you as well, bringing about your ruin in the eyes of society, yes, I must ask that you trust me. In exchange, I offer you the complete, utter, and virtual instantaneous negation of your betrayer's political career." She lowered her eyes again and seemed to consider.
"Could you do that? Really?"
she asked. "Your testament alone will serve. I shall be merely the instrument of its delivery."
"Now," she said at last, "if I were to denounce him publicly, then I would expose myself as well. Charles isn't the only one I need to fear, as you yourself have said. Remember, I was there that night in Grand's. I know how long an arm revenge can have."
"I've not suggested denouncing him publicly. Blackmail will suffice." Now her eyes were far away, as if she walked the distant pavements of memory.
"They were so close, Charles and my father, or so it seemed. Perhaps if things had taken a different turn. Egremont lives daily with that betrayal. It is the crucial grain of constant irritation around which his depraved politics have been allowed to form. Your telegram galvanized his guilt, his terror of those early Luddite sympathies being revealed. Now he would tame the beast, make political terror his constant ally. But you and I stand in his way.
The blue eyes were strangely calm.
I find I wish to believe you, Mr. Oliphant.
I will keep you safe, Oliphant said, quite startled by his own intensity. So long as you choose to remain in France, you shall do so under the protection of powerful friends, colleagues of mine, agents of the Imperial Court. A cab awaits us, and a stenographer, to take down the details of your testimony.
With a tortured, flatulent wheeze of compressed air, a small panmelodeon was activated at the rear of the café. Oliphant, turning, caught the eye of the mouchard Perrault, who was smoking a Dutch clay pipe amid a cluster of chattering kinotropistes.
"Madame Tournachon," Oliphant said, rising, "may I offer you my arm?" "It's healed, has it?"
She rose in a rustle of crinoline.
"Entirely," Oliphant said,
remembering the lightning stroke of the samurai's sword in Edo amid the shadows. He had been attempting to hold the fellow off with a riding crop. As the engine-driven music of the grand pan melodeon brought the grisettes from their chairs, she took his arm. A girl burst in then from the street, her naked breasts daubed with green. About her waist were strung angular constructs of copper foil, like the leaves of a date palm approximated by a kinotrope. She was followed by two boys in a similar lack of attire, and Oliphant felt utterly lost.
"Come, then," Sybil said. "Don't you know they're art students and been to a bal? It's Montmartre, you know. And the art students, they've such a mad and lovely time."
Oliphant had entertained the gallant notion of personally delivering to Charles Egremont a transcript of Sybil Gerard's testimony. But upon his return to England, those symptoms of advanced syphilis, which Dr. McNeil had incorrectly diagnosed as railway spine, temporarily overcame him. Disguised as a commercial traveller from Monsieur Arslau's native Alsace, Oliphant went to ground in Brighton's hydropathic spa to take the waters and dispatch a number of telegrams. Mr. Mori Arinori arrives in Belgravia at 4:15, driving a new model Zephyr Gurney leased from a commercial garage in Camden Town, just as Charles Egremont is departing for Parliament and a most important speech. Egremont's bodyguard, on assignment from the Central Statistics Bureau's Department of Criminal Anthropometry, a machine carbine slung beneath his coat, watches as Mori descends from the Zephyr, a diminutive figure in evening clothes. Mori marches straight across the new-fallen snow, his boots leaving perfect prints upon the black macadam.
"For you, sir," Mori says, and bows, handing Egremont the stout manila envelope. "A very good day to you, sir."
Donning round goggles with an elasticated band, Mori returns to his Zephyr.
"What an extraordinary little personage," Egremont says, looking down at the envelope. "One hasn't seen a Chinaman got up like that."
"Recede. Reiterate. Rise above these black patterns of wheel tracks, these snow-swept streets, into the great map of London, forgetting." Modus. The images tabled. The language of signs. The circular arrangement of the axes of the difference engine round large central wheels led to the most extended prospects. The whole of arithmetic now appeared within the grasp of mechanism. A vague glimpse even of an analytical engine opened out, and I pursued with enthusiasm the shadowy vision. The drawings and the experiments were of the most costly kind. Draftsmen of the highest order were engaged to economize the labour of my own head, whilst skilled workmen executed the experimental machinery. In order to carry out my pursuits successfully, I had purchased a house with about 1/4 acre of ground in a very quiet locality in London. My coach-house was converted into a forge and foundry, whilst my stables were transformed into a workshop. I built other extensive workshops myself and had a fireproof building for my drawings and draftsmen. The complicated relations amongst the various parts of the machinery would have baffled the most tenacious memory.
I overcame that difficulty by improving and extending a language of signs, the mechanical notation, which in 1826 I had explained in a paper printed in the Philosophic Transactions of the Royal Society. By such means I succeeded in mastering a train of investigation so vast in extent that no length of years could otherwise have enabled me to control it. By the aid of the language of signs, the engine became a reality. Lord Charles Babbage, Passages in the Life of a Philosopher, 1864. Letters from Our Readers. From The Mechanics Magazine, 1830. To judge by readers' letters we receive, certain among our public would doubt that political matters come within the province of this journal. But the interests of science and manufacturing are inextricably mixed with a nation's political philosophy. How, then, can we be silent? We look with delight for a grand new age for science, as well as to every other productive interest of this country, from the election to Parliament of a man of Mr. Babbage's eminence in the scientific world, his tried independence of spirit, his very searching and business-like habits. Therefore we say forthrightly to every elector of Finsbury who is a reader of this journal, go and vote for Mr. Babbage. If you are an inventor whom the ubiquitous and oppressive tax on patents shuts out from the field of fair competition, and desire to see that tax replaced by a wise and deliberate system of public subsidies, go and vote for Mr. Babbage. If you are a manufacturer, harassed and obstructed in your operations by the fiscal stupidities of the present government, if you would see British industry become as free as the air you breathe, go and vote for Mr. Babbage. If you are a mechanic and depend for your daily bread on a constant and steady demand for the products of your skill, and are aware of the influence of free trade on your fortunes, go and vote for Mr. Babbage. If you are a devotee of science and progress, principle and practice united as bone and sinew, then meet us today on Islington Green and vote for Mr. Babbage. In the Time of Troubles. The results of the general election of 1830 made public feeling obvious. Byron and his radicals had captured the tone of the day, and the Whig party were in utter shambles. Lord Wellington's Tories, however, resenting the threat to aristocratic privilege posed by radical proposals of merit lordship, took a hard line. The Commons procrastinated on the Radical Reform Bill, and on the 8th of October the Lords threw it out. The King refused to create new radical peers who might force the bill through. On the contrary, the Fitzclarences were ennobled instead, leading Byron to comment bitterly, "How much better it is to be a royal bastard than a philosopher in England at present. But a mighty change is at hand." Popular pressure mounted swiftly. In Birmingham, Liverpool, and Manchester, the working class, inspired by Babbage's ideals of union ownership and mutual cooperatives, took to the streets in massive torchlight parades. The Industrial Radical Party, disdaining violence, called for moral suasion and a peaceful mass campaign for redress of legitimate grievances. But the government remained stubborn, and events took an ugly turn. In a rising crescendo of random outrage, violent rural swing bands and proletarian Luddites attacked aristocratic homes and capitalist factories alike. Mobs in London shattered the windows in the house of the Duke of Wellington and other Tory peers, and cobblestones in hand, lay sullenly in wait for the passing carriages of the elite. The Anglican bishops who had voted against reform in the Lords were burned in effigy. Ultra-radical conspirators, fired to frenzy by the furious polemics of the atheist P.B. Shelley, attacked and looted establishment churches. On the 12th of December, Lord Byron introduced a new reform bill, more radical yet, proposing outright disfranchisement of the hereditary British aristocracy, including himself. This was more than the Tories could bear, and Wellington involved himself in covert planning for a military coup. The crisis had polarised the nation. At this juncture, the middle classes, terrified of the prospect of anarchy, made their own move and came down on the side of the radicals. A tax strike was declared to force Wellington from office. There was a deliberate run on the banks in which merchants demanded and hoarded gold specie, bringing the national economy to a grinding halt. In Bristol, after 3 days of major riots, Wellington ordered the army to put down Jacobinism by any means necessary. In the resulting massacre, 300 people, including 3 prominent radical MPs, lost their lives. When the news of the massacre reached him, a furious Byron, now calling himself Citizen Byron, and appearing without coat or necktie at a London rally, called for a general strike. This rally was also attacked by Tory cavalry, with bloody results, but Byron eluded capture. 2 days later, the nation was under martial law. In future, the Duke of Wellington would turn his considerable military genius against his own countrymen. The first uprisings against the Tory regime, as it must now be called, were swiftly and efficiently put down, while garrison troops ruled all major cities. The army remained loyal to the victor of Waterloo, and the aristocracy, to their discredit, also threw in their lot with the Duke. But the Radical Party elite had escaped apprehension, abetted by a well-organized covert network of party faithful. By the spring of 31, any hope of a swift military solution was over. Mass hangings and deportations were answered by sullen resistance and vicious guerrilla reprisals. The regime had destroyed any vestige of popular support, and England was in the throes of class war. The Time of Troubles, A Popular History, 1912, by W. E. Pratchett, Ph.D., FRS.